You're listening to Trot the Egging, hosted by John Hetherington, working with Widnes Rugby Union Football Club, sponsored by Boydells.
This week's rugby story is that of a Hull lad who grew up just down the road from the famous Boulevard. Rugby league was something he was good at, a real workhorse who'd done the little tough things that helped others shine. These qualities were spotted by clubs as he managed to tick the rep boxes growing up. A big move came about to Leeds Rhinos, and as they say, the rest is history. A career which included spells with Mackay Cutters, London Broncos and Hull KR. A fine fella who now helped produce the next generation of talent for Hull KR. Ladies and gents, Mr. Jason Netherton.
Follow, like, share, subscribe and endorse us via Facebook, Trot the Egging, Twitter @TrotTheEgging/@JohnHeth, Instagram @Trot_D_Egg_In, YouTube Trot the Egging, LinkedIn John Hetherington, and Spotify Trot the Egging.
Jace, how have you been, mate?
Yeah, good, mate. Thank you. Yeah. Busy pre-season underway at the moment for the academy and the scholarship. So, we're just coming to the back end of it now. It's been a long old pre-season. It started in the first week in November and it's still going strong now. So, we've got some games coming up early March. So, we're ready to get going.
So it is a fair pre-season, really, mate, at that level then, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's, 4 months? It's a long time. I think the players are ready to start playing some games now. There's only so much stimulation you can get from training and, the end product for a rugby player is to play some games. So, they're about ready to go now.
Good stuff, mate. So before we get stuck into your rugby story, Jason, where was home for you and who lived at home with you as a kid?
Home for me was in Hull, was down at a place called Hesel Road in the west of Hull, which is a big fishing community, trawlermen. My dad was a trawlerman, uncle, all the males really in our family was fishermen and that was the community that we had down Hesel Road. It was down to earth, working class people who grafted and liked to drink and, was from the era where the males went out and did that hard job and the females stayed at home and looked after the kids. So there was myself, there was my mum and dad. I had my brother and my sister as well. So it was a fairly full house. We lived about 100, maybe 150 metres away from the Boulevard, Hull FC's old ground. So used to go down there and watch some games when I was a kid.
So how was the competitiveness in your house as a kid then with having a brother and a sister? How was that?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were fairly close. I think there's 2 years between me and my younger sister and then there was another 2 years between me and my youngest brother. So it was competitive. He was a live wire as well, my younger brother. So we was always sporty. It was the era where you came home from school, you dropped your school bag and you was out. You came home when the streetlights came on. That's what we did. We played with friends and we played had block or whatever it was called, or football or rugby on the gardens and on the streets, and played a few other games that you're probably getting a bit of trouble for now. but back then it's what you did. It's what we did to keep ourselves busy. We didn't have no money, so there was no video games, there was no Xboxes and all the stuff that they've got now. It was entertain yourselves, get outside.
It was. Everyone was like that though, Jace. Everyone was in the same boat, weren't they?
Yeah. I'd love to do it now. Honestly, the kids nowadays, they're so sheltered. It's completely opposite now. You come home and you don't go out your bedroom.
Scurdy, really, mate, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think the world has changed so dramatically, not for the better, for the worse.
Yeah.
I talk personally now, I wouldn't let my kids out now because I'd be scared of the people and the things that are around.
Yeah.
Getting kidnapped and all the rest of the stuff that goes with that, that would frighten the life out of me. And it probably happened back then, but you just never knew about it because there was no social media. Something happens now and it's gone around the world in 20 minutes.
100%, yeah.
Which is good, but it's not so good as well, because I think it's turned us all into scaredy cats.
Yeah. I know, you wouldn't go in for your tea if your mum shouted you, mate. You weren't allowed back out then, was you?
That was it. It was drop your bag, you came home for your tea.
Yeah.
You know, you went back out and just come home when it gets dark, and that was it. And your mum has give you some boundaries not to go past. Don't go past, you know, wherever she'd give you, and you never. But you didn't need to, because you was wee mates and he was doing what young kids do. It was brilliant.
That's it, mate. So you touched on the boulevard, really. So I imagine it was pretty early, but how was you introduced to rugby, and where was your first junior club?
It started when I was about 10. Same story as most people. You know, my friends was playing, asked me to go along training, went training, loved it instantly, and got to take out some aggression and some energy and have a good time with your mates and, you know, be young kids. I remember playing my first, strangely, because it's so long ago, I remember playing my first game and I got stud cut right across my knee, and it was probably about 6 inches long, not deep, but it was a decent cut, like, and I've still got the scar now, but I just remember, and I don't know why, I just loved it. It was like, yeah, there you go, you know.
We were from the off, mate.
Yeah, that was it. And because of where I lived, I'd seen the crowds flocking to and from Boulevard to rugby all the time, and my dad was a big rugby fan, and again, a family of rugby fans. My dad used to play back in the 60s and 70s, and he was a very good amateur player. But he could have been professional, everyone tells me all the time how good he was. But I think he got into drink and women, decided against that kind of career path and went on the ships instead. So it was always in the family, it was always around the friends, and you know, once I got into it, I never stopped.
Was you told that from a young age, Jess? Was it ever any pressure on you how good your dad was, or was you just allowed to go and play?
No, there wasn't. No, there was no pressure. I was allowed to play. My dad didn't come and watch me that often because he was at sea. So how they used to do it back then was you would get one day off for every week he was away. So he'd go away for a month at a time, and he'd only be home for 4 days. And that, you know, that could be midweek, or go away for 6 weeks and be home for 6 days. It was just how it was. And so he never got to see many games. So he never put, he wasn't one of them dads who would stand on the sideline and give me any kind of feedback, really. My mum was the get off his head or run it, gate. But yeah, he's typical mother, like you don't really, you know, take what she says with a pinch of salt. But yeah, there was no pressure. People now even tell me, oh, was you Bob? Are you Bob's son? Oh God, he was a good player, you know. So yeah, he could have been a good one, I think. But like I said, he chose alcohol and he chose fishing. And
it was Jace on it. It doesn't always go the way it maybe should or whatever. It's just how it works, mate.
Yeah, again, it was a generational thing for him. Yeah. His dad being a fisherman and all his friends going into the trawlers, so it was just a progression for him and a natural path. It was something I toyed with for a small time, but my mum had never let me go. I was going to go when I was 16. They kind of snuck you aboard, some people. And my dad was going to do that, but my mother would, she wouldn't have it. She said, I can deal with one of you dying, but I can't have you both. So it was...
The most scary times, mate. We, us younger ones, don't really understand that, do we?
No.
Like, the pits, the trawlermen, that sort of thing's, like, phased out, hasn't it?
Dangerous jobs. I mean, obviously, coming from Hull, I hear all the stories about the trawlers that went down in the bad weather, like the Gaul. You hear about the Gaul and plenty of other ships that went down. And I used to go and pick my dad up from the docks, and sometimes we'd go to Grimsby and we'd sail from Grimsby to Hull, and they'd let me on the ship. And even then, just coming down the River Humber, it'd be moving around a bit. It'd be a bit scary for me. So I remember one time my dad's friend died on the ship. He one of the wires snapped, and it was all steel wires back then. And one of the wires snapped, and it took his head off, took his head clean off. So obviously he's died instantly. And I remember my dad was the one that had to pick his head up and put it in a bag, and it traumatized him for quite a while. My dad had to retire. He trapped his arm in one of the winch doors at the back, and they weigh about 4 ton.
Yeah.
Well, he got his arm trapped in the winch, and he couldn't use his arm anymore. He had it. They managed to patch it up and did skin graft stuff, but he never got the use of his arm again. So it was a dangerous old job.
Yeah, and there was none of the mental health stuff then, mate, was there? You probably just expected to get on with it after like his mate and that.
There was big tough men, weren't they? It was man up, you know, get over it and get back out there. And I remember, I mean, there was tough fellas, there was tough blokes.
Yeah.
I think they used to have a few scraps. I remember again a few times my dad had come home and we'd pick him up on the side of the dock and he'd have a black eye or two, and I think they'd had a bit of a crack at the at sea. That's just what it's men putting men together in a small area.
So it had been a straight then as well, which is unfamiliar now, isn't it?
I think they had a few straighteners, but again, men back then, you just shook hands and
it was gone. Yeah,
gone with it. Yeah,
yeah.
Tough time,
but yeah, it was. It was very different, but probably much for the better, like we've said, mate, wasn't it? Like if you were cheeky to someone in the street, you got a clip, didn't you? And people left the front doors open because they knew everyone, and no one had much more than anyone else. It was just the music was good as well, mate, wasn't it?
It was for you guys over that way, yeah. It was good music. My mum and dad, massive Beatles fan. My mum comes to Liverpool all the time. She goes about 4 or 5 times a year. She loves it there.
Good stuff, mate. So was there any rep stuff, like town team stuff for you, Jace, at 11 or 12, around that age?
Yeah, again, it was different. It was different then to what it is now. So it was Humberside then. Humberside's no more, but you had Humberside under 12s and 13s, 14s, etc. And then you also had, it was a strong schools league back then, so I played for Hull Schools. And again, I would go back to that now if I could. I think they got rid of it partly because, again, the world's changed, but they didn't want to, they didn't want representative rugby at under 12s and 13s and 14s because it should be all inclusive for every player. But again, back then it was, so you would get picked for Hull Schools. You play for your school, you get selected for Hull Schools, you'd then play in a league against Leeds Schools and Cass Schools and Huddersfield and whoever, and then from that the selectors would pick a Yorkshire Schools. You'd play like a tri-series against Cumbria and Lancashire, and then from that you got picked for England Schools and you'd play against France. We played against France for England Schools under 16s. I think it was the week before they knocked Central Park down when Wigan moved. So that's my claim to fame.
So, it's a good fact. You're probably the last game then, eh?
Yeah, we would have. Well, we played before Wigan played St. Helens in the derby. So there was 20-odd thousand there at Central Park. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Good times, mate, again. Good time.
Yeah. So, like you said, you'd have that back, mate. I didn't understand why they got rid of. Obviously, it takes people like yourselves to tell us, but was that something you'd aspire to do anyway? Did you ever get like knocked back at a young age? And if you didn't, how do you think you might have took that?
No, I was fairly lucky in that I had quite a good amateur career. I was older. I was born in October, so I was one of the bigger ones in the year group. So I wouldn't say it was easy, but I was one of the better players. If I'd have been born August time, it might have been different. But for me back then, it was fairly linear to the top kind of thing. But it was strangely, it was never something I aspired to do. I didn't dream of being a professional. Not until I was about 13, 14, but maybe even old, maybe 14, 15. I just did it. I did it because I enjoyed being with my mates and I loved the game, and it was good to get out and train on the night and Saturday mornings and play on a Sunday, give you something to do on a weekend and focus, and I just enjoyed it. And then some things started coming my way, you know, and then I started to think, you know what, I want to do this as a job.
So what were you like in the trial sort of setup, mate? Was you someone that was quite comfortable in that? Because there is a little bit of pressure there, Jason. So was you comfortable in the trial sort of period of things, or?
No. So what? I never had much self-confidence. How it happened for me was we was playing for Hull Schools against Leeds, and Dean Bell was the academy coach at Leeds. And I'd already been to Hull Sharks, there was back then, and Hull KR. Yeah. And they, you know, they was interested. They wanted us to go there. And then we got invited by Leeds Rhinos to go for a training weekend there. And it was a full weekend, so that you went down on the Friday, you went over to Leeds on the Friday, you watched their Super League game. I think it was against Castleford.
Yeah.
You stayed over Friday night. Then on the Saturday, you went to it's Leeds Beckett University now. You went there, you had a full day's training. There was 30 of us. You did some lectures on the night time, and then on the Sunday you trained again, and then on the Sunday afternoon you had a game. It was like a trial game. And then they selected who they wanted from that. And in the teams that era, that year group, there was myself, but then there was pretty much all the golden generation of kids at Leeds. So there was Danny Maguire, there was Rob Burrow, there was Ryan Bailey, there was Chev Walker. It was an outstanding group. Danny Brough was on that trial. Kirk Yeaman was on that trial from Hull FC, ended up going to Hull FC. So there was Jamie Langley, I think, was there. It was a really, really, you know, it was a really good year group, that year group. And I remember I got man of the match in the game. I didn't even think I'd play that well. Anyway, but Dean and Bob Pickles, the head scout, came over to my mum after the game and just said, can we meet up with you next week? Talk to you about signing Jay. So that was how it took off from Leeds. They came over to Hull the following week and we met up with them. There was only one place I was going to go when they asked me to go there. It was Leeds.
Yeah. Imagine it's some experience for a young lad as well, and it's a serious thing when you get, like you said, to 14, 15. That's when it becomes about predominantly winning, and then becomes about being better than your opposite man, so to say, doesn't it, mate? Then at that age, and when the scouts coming and stuff,
it really was, and without being disrespectful to Hull FC and Hull KR at that time, there was nowhere near where Leeds Rhinos was. Leeds have always been the glamour club, haven't they? They've always been like the big rich club. And Dean Bell is just a legend of the sport. Like, if Dean Bell knows your name, you're winning already. So, you know, for him to come over, shake my hand and call me Jason was just like, oh my God, you know, this is a rugby league god. The stuff that he won at Wigan, you know, and as a New Zealand captain was just phenomenal. So just to have them people know who I was enough. Even if they didn't want to sign me and they just knew my name, that I would have won. But the fact they wanted me to go and join Leeds was just unreal. There was myself and there was my best mate at the time, Glenn Donkin. And so we'd sign there. And, you know, kids now want so much and back then, I signed a contract and I was getting paid £2,500 a year. That was the contract, £2,500, and then it went up to £3,000. Out of that £2,500, I had to get the train to Leeds four times a week, and it was £18 a return. So it ended up costing my mother money for me to go and play for Leeds. She was scratching around trying to find money back end of the week to afford me to be able to go to Leeds and train. You know, when I hear stories now and deal with kids who kind of scoff at more money than that. I just think, wow, you know, you don't really want it enough.
Yeah.
That was an inspiration to me. I want to be a professional now. I'm going to bust my ass. And we had to travel. My day started at 7, woke up, went to college. Excuse me. Went to college, finished college, walked all the way from, well, it would have been about a 3-mile walk to the train station, jumped the train to Leeds, got another train from Leeds train station to the training ground. So 2 trains. We'd get a lift back to the train station. We'd get home at 10 to 10. My mate's mother would pick us up. Sorry, 10 to 11. The train was at 10 to 10. We'd get home at 10 to 11. My mate's mother would pick us up, take me home in the car. I'd be home for just after 11 and I'd go to sleep. And I did that 4 days a week, from being out my house from 8 o'clock till 11. Just because I wanted to be a professional. Like, you know, I'm going to do what I can. I'm not going to die wandering. I was never ever a skillful, you know, talented player, but I grafted my tits off. And I think that's probably where that work ethic came from.
Yeah, you work right or outshine talent, won't it, if the talent doesn't work, sort of thing. That's the saying, isn't it?
Yeah. Talent will get you in the room, but effort will keep you in. Talent will get you through the door, effort will keep you in the room. And I was an effort-based player, always. I couldn't pass, I couldn't kick, I wasn't particularly fast, but I'd bust my ass every day for you. And I had to.
Yeah.
I had to. If I didn't, I wouldn't have been in the team.
Yeah. And if you do your bit nowadays, mate, the money will come, won't it? You've just got to earn the right first, as you do on the field for a win, isn't it? You have to earn the right.
Yeah, that was it. It was get paid nothing now, but live the dream as a Super League player and you get more money. I did 3 years of 3 years of earning no money whatsoever and my mother having to pay for me, bless her. I had to stay at college, she forced me to stay at college, hated it. But I had to stay at college just so she would continue to get a family allowance. That's how tight it was. So she would get that extra money so we can afford for me to go and get my train. And then I did that for 3 years, and then I got offered a 5-year contract at Leeds, which is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I was getting paid. I went from like 3,000 to 15,000, and then it went up to 18. And I was only 18 years old, and it was like, oh my God. That was when I got a bit silly and started buying Versace shirts and stuff. But for a little time there, it was just hard work, mate. You had to sacrifice everything. You know, and it's what I tell the players nowadays when I deal with them is don't die wondering. Don't walk away knowing that you could have done more.
Yeah.
Even if you don't get to be a full-time professional, you don't get to live the dream of being a Super League player, as long as you've tried your hardest, that is literally all you can do. That is all you can do. Don't walk away and look in the mirror and think, I should have done more, I could have done more.
Yeah, no, 100%, mate. So if we just rewind a little bit, mate, how did you find the transition into senior school then? Did you reckon the rugby helped with that?
I was a little shit in school.
Was
you? I was, funnily enough, I was speaking to my old teacher. I saw my old teacher today from high school, today of all days, and she's saying he was a little sod at school. I said, oh, I wasn't that bad. She said, you was a lovable rogue. And I thought, yeah, I'll take that title. But I probably treat school like I treat rugby. It was a chance to be with my mates and have a bit of a laugh and a giggle. I was never educational. I was intelligent, very intelligent, but I wasn't bothered.
Your partnering just wasn't for you, mate.
No, just I didn't aspire to go to college or university. Or again, I was fisherman's son. You know, no one in my family did anything more than, you know, working jobs, like manual jobs. So it just wasn't something that I aspired to do. So I didn't probably put in as much effort as I should have done. And then I signed a contract at Leeds when I was 15. And then I won't say I got arrogant, but I knew then in my head that I was going to be a Super League player. I just didn't. I was so tunnel visioned into doing that, that there was never anything that was ever going to stop me from doing it. So when it came to exams and things, I didn't put as much effort in as I should have. I wish I had.
No,
I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the standard of school rugby like, mate, compared to club rugby?
It wasn't as good as club rugby, because in club rugby, the best players kind of congregate to a certain club or a certain team, whereas school rugby, obviously, it depends where you are in the city. So the talent is kind of more spread out, and the players who don't normally play the game would have a game because they fancied it. So
yeah. All the filling in where you didn't have people and stuff.
Yeah. So yeah. The standard of school rugby wasn't as high, but again, it was just playing rugby. You got your hands on the ball and got to play rugby with your mates, and this time with your schoolmates who you don't see on a weekend. So I loved it. Any game was a good game, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the union when you were growing up, mate?
No. Rugby union in Hull has got stronger over the last few years, but back then it was working class. It was all rugby league. Even football wasn't big in Hull then. It was LFC and LKR, and you know, Hull City played at Bulfrey Park, and they was in Division 3 or 4. Like there was nowhere near as big as what it is now. I think 5, 6, 7 years ago, the RFU came into Hull and spent some money and tried to, you know, lift the game up here. But before that, there was no rugby union now.
Yeah, and just touching on that with you saying that, how was that for catchment of talent, which we'll talk about your role a little bit later on, what you're in now, but did that cause a bit of competition for you when the RFU come up, or was you quite content with the fact that you were the number one pull in Hull, really?
No, it didn't. It didn't, because here anyway, it's still very tribal. It's still very... LFC, LKR. There's a few clubs that have come in from outside, but they're all rugby league. Rugby union, we find a lot of rugby union players now play rugby league as well.
We get that here as well.
Yeah, we encourage it. We've got some lads who we've had on our scholarships who've told us that they play, I can't remember what they call it, the ED.
Ionians.
Yeah, and we just say, go on, play it. Play as many sports as you can. When it comes to getting paid and being an academy player, then you'll have to make a decision. But whilst you're at school, go and play as many sports as you possibly can. We'll support that, absolutely. There's never really been any issue.
Plus, overall, mate, it's only going to enhance their ability, isn't it? Ball handling, techniques, coordinations, all that type of thing.
There's so many transferable skills.
Yeah.
So many. Whilst I don't like rugby union, I find it quite boring. I appreciate that there's a hell of a lot of technical skill in the sport. You know, it's rugby league's very gladiatorial, very physical, whereas rugby union is a lot more technical. And I completely understand that, and I respect it. And I like the catch pass in rugby union is getting a lot better. And I like the tackle technique in rugby union. There is now. Yeah. There's getting more and more influence of rugby league in regards to structures and things, because rugby league defences have to be very structured because it's so open.
Yeah.
But you know, the rugby union players, I wish there'd be a few more that had come over to the sport. Obviously, money plays a big part in that, but I think there's some very skillful players in rugby. I'd love to have seen Johnny Wilkinson in a rugby league shirt. I really would. I think he would have made it in rugby league. He was a tough kid. That kind of era for rugby union is the only era that I've really watched England, and and paid any attention to it.
Fair enough, mate. That's fair enough. So when you're growing up, mate, and you're looking at playing the rugby league, are you having to make the sacrifices that kids don't quite understand now? And do you get frustrated with that a little bit? Or are you noticing a more professional outlook on life from the youngsters now?
The group that we've got now are very dedicated. So I think, anyway, I mean, I don't see him every day and every night, but the sacrifice I had to make back then, and, you know, was things like, you know, your nights out that people would go on a Saturday and I had a game on a Sunday, or, you know, hanging on the street corners with your mates back then and drinking the cheap cider. I'd only have one bottle instead of two. No, look, but like I said, I wasn't getting home till 11 o'clock most nights, so there was no way I could have done anything anyway.
Yeah.
I wasn't a saint, not by any stretch of the imagination. I still had a night out when the time was right to out, but I understood when that was. And I think the lads nowadays, the ones we've got anyway, are very much the same. I encourage them, if they're over 18 anyway, I encourage them to go out and be with their friends, and you have to switch off. I don't think you can live and breathe the game 24/7. You have to be a young lad. You have to, you know, spend time with your mates and your family and your girlfriends and whatever else they've got. So I encourage it, but understand what the end goal is for you. You can spend the rest of your life going on nights out.
So when signing for Leeds come about, mate, how does that process work? So did they come to your house when you agreed the deal? And what does signing for a pro club entail? So you mentioned a little bit about the train journeys and stuff, mate. So add a little bit more to that, if you don't mind, about the people and the culture that they try and drive then. Was it a little bit more professional than others at the time, with them being such a big club?
Yeah, Leeds was and always have been so professional and so well run and managed. Certainly in the time since I was there and now. Like I said, after the game on the weekend, they came over to Hull. They didn't come to my house. We met them in a hotel. It was Dean Bell and Bob Pickles, who was their chief scout back then. Really nice fellow was Bob. And basically said, I think it was £500 signing on fee. And £2,500 a year, I think it was, or £2,000 a year. £2,500. And that was amazing. Again, I got 500 quid in my pocket. Me and my mate and best mate Glenn, who signed as well, we went out and bought mobile phones, which we was the first people in our high school to get mobile phones. Yeah. I remember it was a big fat Motorola phone. And I don't know why we bought them, because none of our mates had mobile phones, so we could only ring each other. So yeah,
we went out. Did you bypass the page? Did you, Jason? Went straight to the mobile.
Yeah, we was big time, man. We had 500 quid in our pocket. it was before you couldn't even send text messages. It was before text messages and all. So it was. I don't know why we got them. But yeah, so we signed there, and then we'd go and train at Leeds, and they trained at a place called Tetley's. I'm assuming Tetley owned it. Tetley's Bitter. It was ultra professional. Kevin Sinfield was in the squad, and Jamie Jones Buchanan, Gareth Carvel, all that era of player, as well as the ones I'd mentioned earlier that was just starting. You could see there was something special at the club. Leeds had won the Academy League, I think, the previous 3 years, and we went on to win it for the next 3-4 years as well. We was the pinnacle at that age. We had some good tussles with Wigan. Wigan had some good players as well. So they had players like Sean O'Loughlin playing for them. Gareth Hock came through. Sean Briscoe. Billy Joe Edwards, who was Sean Edwards' brother, who unfortunately died when he was fairly young. He played there. They had a very good team. So we had some good tussles, but by and large, Leeds always came out on top. I think we was unbeaten at home for about 3 years. And luckily for me, I wasn't playing in the game. I was injured in the game where we got beat by Castleford to break the record. But yeah, it was ultra professional, which is what I loved. I loved because the standards were so high, you had to meet them or otherwise you'd get found out. And so it was a challenge. You know, when you're training and playing with the likes of Kevin Sinfield, you have to meet that challenge. You have to be at that standard. And there was many, many players, more talented players than me who didn't, because of, you know, various things, didn't meet that challenge and didn't make it, didn't get through the end.
And them sort of mantras that we touched on before, Jace, isn't it? It's all about the effort markers that people look for, the talent or follow the effort, won't it?
Yeah, it will. And I met some brilliant people there, brilliant people who I still speak to. Still speak to Rob fairly regularly. I see Danny, obviously, he's working at OKR now. So I'm in the Leeds Rhinos ex-players WhatsApp group. So, that, you know, they're all in there. I don't really say much because some of them are absolute legends of the sport. So I just sit back and go, wow, I'm in a WhatsApp group with Adrian Morley. Yeah.
So how did you carry on with competing for success? Because a lot of teams maybe sit on laurels, don't they? How do you go against letting complacency creep in? Or is it them type of characters that drill it into you that you can't stagnate, sort of thing?
Yeah, it was the players around you and the people around you. Even when Dean Bell left and the next coach came in, Mick Cook or Stuart Wilkinson, even when the head coaches would leave the club, the club ethos was like, you're going to graft hard and you're going to work hard. And there's no coincidence that Leeds had the success that they had for so long with that group of players that came through. There's no, it's not by accident. They drove the culture, them players. You either towed the line and dug in or shipped out, basically. And I don't know if the sport will ever see a group all come through at the same time again like that. It was like, they talk about the Man United class of 92 with Giggs and
Beckham. Yeah.
Exactly the same there at Leeds. I don't know if there'll ever be a repeat. I hope there is, and I hope it's at OKR in the next few years.
Yeah. So do you think that's why that transition a couple of years ago with the fans so hard? Because they've only ever known success for a long time, haven't they? And if they hadn't won it, they were up there competing, wasn't they?
Yeah. They all grew. You know, there was all together for so many years. I don't think the club really planned for them to leave because they never knew when they was going to, even when they got old. Like, you know, Kev played mid-30s and Rob and Danny played till it was mid-30s. And when do you start to plan? When do you know they're going to go? Like, if they want to play for another year, you're going to give them another year because of how good they are and what they do for the club. So I think the club at Leeds did struggle for a few years. I think they probably still are. You know, I think they probably exceeded expectations last year. But I think they're finding a way to recover. They've got some good people working in their academy now and they're getting some shoots and they'll always promote from within with Leeds because that's a part of that club ethos. But I don't think any club could have replaced those players and carried on and made it seamless. It was always going to be a
transition
group left.
Definitely, mate. Because it weren't just one or two, it was a full spine and some huge characters, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, some of the legends of Super League, like, they weren't even just good players. There was, like, Danny Maggs, he's still the top try scorer in Super League history. Like, he'll go down as one of the best standoffs that Leeds have ever had. Kevin Sinfield is probably the best player Leeds have ever had. Rob Burrow's not far behind. Jamie Jones Buchanan played 500-600 games. Like, you just don't replace them easily. You just can't. It's not even so much what they do on the field. It's who they are and the aura that they have around them. When they're in the room, you know they're in the room, and you pay attention to them. And it was always going to be a struggle.
Yeah. So how did you find the step up in level from academy to first team?
It's obviously a mile's part, but back then there was a reserve grade, and it was strong. It was it was a really strong reserve league. It was a proper league. They're starting to get somewhere like that now. It's still going to take a few years, but you know, but I remember making my reserves debut, playing against Warrington at Wilderspool. I was 18, and they had Mark Hilton playing. They had Lee Penny playing. They had Gary Chambers. These was men. I was a boy. These was guys, like big, you know, bald-headed Mark Hilton playing in the front row. Like, you, Sanko Swam, like, you had to play well, otherwise you'd have ran all over you. This was a proper fella. I remember that vividly, playing in then. And because I'd stepped up to the reserves, I was playing with people like Dean Lawford, who was playing in that game, Francis Cummins in there. You're just like, oh wow, like these are Super League players. I have to step up. I have to play good. Again, otherwise I'll get cast aside and left behind. So it was huge, but there was a stepping stone towards Super League. It wasn't just Academy then Super League. I remember a little bit of trivial fact for you. Leeds played St Helens in the Challenge Cup semi-final at JJB Stadium. It would have been 2001. And the day before, I was sat at home, and Mick Cook rang me, who was the assistant first team coach, and he was our academy coach. I'd never trained with the first team. And he rang me, and I was like, what does he want? So on my house phone, because no one rang on mobile.
Online, yeah.
And he just said, oh, what are you doing tomorrow? So I was like, well, no, why? And he said, well, get yourself over to Wigan. You're playing in the Challenge Cup semi-final. So I was like, oh, shut up, kid. What are you ringing me for? So he said, no, I'm telling you, you need to get to Wigan today, because you're playing in the Challenge Cup semi-final tomorrow. It turns out Leeds had a load of injuries that week. They're literally down to bare bones, and they needed a back row, and they needed a forward, and I was playing pretty well for the academy. So I'd never even trained with the first team. I didn't even know any of the players. I had to get my mum's friend, because my mum didn't drive. I had to get my mum's friend to drive me to Wigan, and all the hotel rooms had gone. So I ended up rooming with Gary Everington. And that was my debut, playing in the Challenge Cup semi-final. I went down on the morning of the game. And again, something I'll never forget. Jamie Matthew was there eating his breakfast. Remember Jamie Matthew? Australian. So he was eating his breakfast, and I wandered in, didn't know him, didn't know me. And he said, some bit of small talk. And he said, you better have a fucking good game today, because this game's worth a shitload of money to me. And I was like, what an asshole you are. What an absolute asshole you are. I was shitting my pants. I'd not slept a minute.
No.
Something I'll always forget. I always remember. Sorry. Ultimately, I didn't get on the field, and I was an unused substitute. But I spent probably 65 minutes of that game shitting my pants, absolutely bricking it, waiting for the call to come that I was going on. It was only like the last 15 minutes when I thought, they're not putting me on here. Like, I kind of started to relax a little bit. But yeah, for 65 minutes, I was bricking it. It was a game. It was when there was a big brawl, and they had St. Helens had a bloke called Peter Shields. I don't know if you remember him, big tall.
Yeah.
He ended up having a scrap with, I think it was Barry, and Barry split him, and he cut him right across his eyebrow. And the dugouts was both sides of the tunnel, and I was sat right on the edge of the dugout as he ran into the changing room to get stitched up. And I saw him, and I thought, oh my God, if I get on today, you're going to kick my ass. So I never get on. So I kind of, it was my debut, but not my playing debut. And then I got to play. My actual Super League debut for Leeds was against Hull FC at the Boulevard, which was very handy because I only lived a couple of hundred metres away from it. So I literally walked to the ground in my Leeds trackie, shit in my pants that I was going to get. So yeah, I made my debut for Leeds against LFC. It was on Friday night Sky TV, and we won. And it was the first time. Sorry, I think it was the third time Leeds had beat Hull FC at Boulevard in like 30 years. Some stupid stat. And we won 15-8, and Danny Ward kicked a drop goal. Front row.
Yeah, he didn't tell me that.
Yeah, he kicked a drop goal. Yeah, we won 15-8, I remember.
That was do you know when you're just playing up the road, mate, for like a club such as that? Do you realise how far you've come in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, obviously all my mates was there and the family, and I was 18 at the time. So it was a special moment. I remember Yistin, I got in trouble because I was warming up, and I don't know if you ever went to the Boulevard. It was a rough place. Crowd was not shy. So I was warming up down the sideline, and I was getting a load of stick, absolutely ripped to pieces about how shit I was and how they're going to kill me and all the rest of it. I got on the field and we won. So as we're walking off, I started doing all the, you know, the wanker signs and that to all the fans and giving them a bit back. Yeah, yeah. I was young and naive.
Yeah, I was expecting you banging the badge or something.
No, I was giving them a little bit of stick as I was walking off, and there was a tunnel. At the Boulevard, it was like a steel tunnel cage that you had to walk through, and the fans was either side of it, and there was like they'd be trying to spit at you and all sorts. And I remember getting in the changing room, and Yistin was just behind me as I was walking in, and he absolutely ripped into me. He said, "Don't ever do that again," like, or words to that effect. But he piled in onto me. So I never did. But yeah, that's another memory of my debut. In terms of recognizing how far would come, it was a special moment to have all my family there. Most of them dressed in black and white for LFC.
trying to spit on you.
They was the ones I was doing the sign to. But yeah, it was a special day. The same game is the game that Kurt Yeaman made his debut, who went on to play God knows how many games for LFC, 400 or 500 games. And I knew Kurt because he was a year younger than me. So I played with and against him for the Hull Schools teams. And we were sat next to each other in the dugout because the dugouts was joined up back then.
All right, okay.
So he was on the end of his and I was on the end of mine. And we was like looking at each other through the wall and saying, "Are you nervous?" and having a bit of a giggle to each other. We both got on and, you know, went on to have decent careers. Like,
that's a nice memory, that, mate, though, isn't it? Because joking aside, with or without the game, friends that you make in the game remain friends a lot of the time, don't they? So it's a nice little moment, that, really.
Yeah, all my friends are rugby friends. I don't really speak to many people from school anymore. But all my best friends are all from rugby. Because you share a bond, like you share something that's pretty hard to explain to someone who hasn't experienced it. There's not many better feelings than being in the trenches with each other. Obviously not literally, but like being, you know, on the field, doing the tough stuff, training with each other and experiencing the wins and the losses and the hard times. And it's something that you can always, if you ever meet up with anyone from years gone, who you play rugby with, you always fall straight back into the changing room banter and always fall back into that kind of conversation, and then memories start coming flooding back, and you spend some special moments with them guys, and you just create bonds forever, don't you?
Yeah. When you're in and around the players you're around, mate, did you ever feel any like you were overawed? Did you know you were good enough? Regardless of the little aspects you touched on before, where you said, "I wasn't great at this, wasn't great at that." Like we said, the effort brings the talent on, doesn't it? So you obviously earned the right to be there, but it doesn't mean that you were always confident about it.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't at all. I had a pretty tough time when I left Leeds. because of the amount of people that came through Leeds at the same time, there was a bit of a bottleneck at the top. So there were some really good players, but not everyone could get through. And I was one of those kids that just couldn't make it. I couldn't take the next step to establish myself in that, you know, world-class team. So Tony Smith came in 2004, and I kind of knew that I wasn't going to be there long-term. I think I had 2 years left of my contract. But I knew, you know, I was getting older. I think I was 20, what I'd be 22 at the time. And you just feel, you just know that I could have stayed, but when you're not getting picked and you're not in the team and you're playing and you're getting put out on loan and things, it was time to go. But that was pretty tough to kind of take that news that you're not going to play in that team, you're not going to be good enough to break through into that team. And then so I left, and then Leeds won the Super League in 2004. Should have stayed for another 6 months. Might have got myself a trophy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. I had a pretty tough time that last then, the 12 months or so that followed that. Because I went from Leeds, which was the most professional, best-run club in the country, to Hull KR, who at that time was not. You know, there was a championship team, there was a part-time team. They had a speedway track and a dog track around the pitch. The pitch was about as big as this laptop. It was it was a tough challenge, tough old challenge. But again, you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about it. At the time, I probably could have quit the game, but
you really felt like that, mate. Yeah,
I could have. I could have done that. I had a tough year. I was going out on the piss a lot, and scrapping and doing stuff what I shouldn't have been doing. It kind of came to a head. We went to Wales. On a pre-season camp for Hull KR. It was a 5-day camp in Wales, and the last day they let us have a night out in Cardiff. But I took it far too far, and I went back to the hotel, and there was a bit of trouble in the hotel, and the club was effectively going to sack me. But I don't know, someone at the time said to me, look, you need to get your head sorted. You can have a career in the game, or you can piss off and go and be in prison. And I think that was kind of the slap in the face I needed. So from that kind of moment on, I just went, yeah, get my head down and get back playing. And I did, and the club gave me a second chance after I promised them to go on a 6-month drinking ban, and managed to get back, and we got the club back to Super League.
So just as you're leaving Leeds, mate, are you someone that, even as a player, because I know your role's changed again, which we'll touch on later on, but was you someone that liked it nice and direct, mate, and honest?
Yeah. I always. So the people that got the most out of me as a coach was people like Dean Bell, who took no shit. And Justin Morgan at Hull KR, again, he was another imposing person. He was another tough character. He told you what he thought, basically, and he didn't skate around the truth, and that was what I needed. I needed to prove myself to someone. That was what it was. I needed someone to like me or think I was a good player, and I think I deserved to be there. And they would tell you that. And that's probably what me as a character needed as a player.
Yeah. So did you when you go to Hull KR, is it about re-establishing yourself and proving to yourself that you can cut it? Because from people I've spoken to in the past, Jace, it's the standard is a little bit lower, but it's a different standard, isn't it? It's not your speed. It's about your ability to override toughness and season pros and the dark arts of the intricacies of rugby league, isn't it?
Yeah. Being totally honest, at the time, I knew I could play. I knew I could handle the level and stuff. Completely honest, at that time, I wanted to come back to Hull because I'd been living in Leeds for a few years, so I wanted to come back to Hull, but I wasn't overly fussed because Leeds didn't want me. I wasn't too bothered where I went. Rugby just wasn't that important at the time. It was only when I got the kick up the arse where I went, what am I doing? Why am I messing about at this? Like, you, you don't spend 10 years working your bollocks off or something and then pack it in just because you can't be bothered. So that was when I went, you know, this club can go somewhere. They're starting to put some money in. They want to get to Super League. Like, that's where I want to get back to be playing. So stop help the team get back to Super League and do your bit kind of thing. So it was about raising the standards as well. So Hull KR again at that time wasn't. There was a squad of part-time players. And what happens there is when the players are part-time, they don't want to get to Super League, because if they do, they're either going to have to give the job up or the club will get rid of them for full-time players. So there's no real incentive for them part-time lads, you know, 27, 28-year-old lads to get to Super League. The club was really smart in that they invested a lot in young Super League players who would, like myself, who would add some taste of Super League and then being let go for whatever reason from other clubs. People like Scott Morrell, people like Ben Cocaine, John Goddard, who was in the team at the time, Gareth Morton, some young, hungry English lads, Ian Morrison, another one, who had had a taste of Super League and they wanted another crack and they're going to work their ass off to get back there. It was real smart management from the club. They started to invest in the facilities off the pitch. So like I said, they had a dog track and a speedway tracker on the pitch. Well, they got rid of those and they made the pitch a decent, you know, standard of pitch, normal width and normal size, and put some money behind the squad and you know, it was all geared up for us to get back to Super League. We just had to do our part, which we did.
Is there a point in the year where you felt maybe untouchable and unplayable? Because you get them sort of games, Jace, don't you, where you just, you know, it's your day, don't you? And everything you touch seems to turn to gold sort of thing.
Yeah, that year we got promoted in 2006. We went on a 24-match, I think it was 24-match winning streak. So we knew, you know, we knew we was good. We knew we could beat any team in there. The key for us was always having our eye on the end goal. We want to be in Super League. And the way that the competition was, you had to win the last game. You could win 25, 26 games and lose that final and you're not there. You know, you've lost. So we had to just remain focused on making sure we won that grand final and got the club where we wanted to be. And we did it with some ease as well, really.
Yeah. And how was the injury list that year? Because you need a bit of luck as well, mate, don't you? You need your core group playing week in, week out, really.
Yeah, and we did. We had, as well as the young, hungry English kids that we got, the club had invested in some smart Australian players as well. So they had James Webster, who was outstanding. He dragged us through that league. They had David Tangatator, who was a front rower, and he could play a bit, and he was smart, and he was a hard-working lad. Byron Ford on the wing, who scored about 4,000 tries. He was, again, wild card off the field, but on the field he could score and try. So we had a really, really good mix of people at the club. Really, really good mix, and it all just kind of gelled. And we had a fit squad. You know, James Webster, who was our best player and our maestro and the guy who dragged us around the pitch, he was fit all year, never missed a game, I don't think so. Him and Scott Morrell worked so well that year as a pair of halfbacks. When you've got your spine injury free all year, you can top it up with anyone around them. And that's what we did. We had a very, very good year that year. We almost to the point where the grand final was a little bit of a anticlimax for us. Like, obviously the end goal was amazing and outstanding, but the game itself, it just wasn't a spectacle, because we always seemed comfortable. It was always kind of comfortable winning the game. So that's how I remember it anyway. There was never a time where we was worried. We had some decent celebrations afterwards, I'll tell you that one.
I can imagine, mate. So when it comes to the big time again and that rolls around, mate, is it time for renegotiations? And are you comfortable in yourself now to to lead them, or did you have like an advisor or anything like that?
Yeah, so on that last year, I had two contracts offered. So there was a Super League contract and a Championship one in case we didn't go up. Obviously, the wage difference was a fair amount, depending on what league it was in. So yeah, there's your incentive for us financially. But I had an agent, David House. He was my agent when I was younger. He was at Leeds. He's a Hull lad, Great Britain manager. He's been in his time and been around the game. So he looked after me. He had a bit of a soft spot for me. Did I was in. He did all my contracts until I was probably 30, and then you know what your value is, and you know what you want, and you know what you're going to get. I don't think you need one when you get older, but in them kind of mid-20s when you're scrapping around for a few more quid and shopping yourself and seeing what your value is on the market and stuff, you probably need one. You probably do, but as you get older, you know what you're worth.
So when you get back into the big time, mate, has much changed? And was the business good from Hull KR, and how was the feel around the club?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Look, we did a bit of a different pre-season. So we went to Torremolinos. We got some new players. We got Mick Vella in, who was just tremendous for us, tremendous. We got some older players who were a bit more established, some tough blokes in the middle like Jim Gannon. Been around the play, about around the game, and he was a tough fella, and you know, he could help some of us young English kids out when it got tough. As alongside Mick, who was obviously an international, but we needed to gel and we needed to believe in ourselves a little bit and be a group. So pre-season, although it was fairly tough, was not physical. It was more about gelling as a team, and we went to Torremolinos for the pre-season camp in January, and the instructions from the coaching staff was basically, as long as you are on the training ground, we don't kind of mind what you do on a night time, basically.
Yeah.
So it became a bit of a lad's holiday. Like, we was out drinking every single night. We found a bar around the corner, a little bar, and it was €1 a pint. And that was when €1 was like 30p back then.
Yeah.
So we, as a squad, was in there every night. But we became close as a team. When you're out drinking, you're fairly honest, aren't you? So you kind of gel as a group. And we went into that season, I think we won 3 out of the first 5 games. We beat Leeds, we beat Wigan, we beat Wakefield in them first 5 games. And we was top of the league after the first month. We were so close as a group and had so much belief in ourselves. And that first night against Wakey at Craven Park under the floodlights is just a memory I'll always have, because we was underdogs, two scrappy teams. So Wakey have always been a bit of a scrappy team, not really glamorous, but they fight hard, and we was the same. And we came out and we won it in the last minute. Benny Cocaine scored under the sticks there, and we won it in the, you know, if you've seen the celebrations, we were so ecstatic. Give us the confidence to go on and beat Leeds, and we beat Wigan as well. So I think after that, we went on a 16-match losing streak, but we started the year.
And then, sorry, mate, go on.
I was going to say, then we lost a load of games, and then we come good at the end again, and then we made it actually mathematically impossible for us to be relegated by smashing LFC at KC Stadium. We beat them 42-6 in the second to last game of the year to keep us up. It was between us and Salford, and we beat Salford the week before, and then we went into the Hull game, and it was, you know, that's what made us safe. So to do that at Hull FC's home ground, and to really, you know, to beat them pretty well was, again, like the Wakey game was just such a special time.
Like a little grand final, really, Jace, isn't it? It's like,
it was like our grand final, because it kept us up. It kept us in Super League for another year. We beat them that well. I remember my dad at the time would not believe me that they had not fixed the game. He thought that there'd been some agreement between the two clubs where, you know, where LFC had thrown the game against us so that we could stay in Super League because it was worth so much money and all that.
That's brilliant, that though. Brilliant.
Yeah. It was good.
So how do you learn off the Mick Vellers and the Jim Gannons when times aren't so good? What goes on where you're under the sticks and you're feeling the heat, or on a Monday in review, or whenever you've done your review, Jace, where were the lessons learnt for you really when the times were hard?
It was just to work hard as a team, just to go back to being together. Like Mick Vella, he was getting towards the back end of his career at the time, but he would always put his hands up to carry the ball, regardless of how tired he was or where he was. He just led through actions. He didn't speak much, probably because he was in the middle of the field and couldn't breathe. But seriously though, but he would carry the ball. He would turn up time and time again. He would do the tough stuff. He'd experienced it. So because he had that experience and he did the hard work, people listened automatically. He was a leader through actions and not so much words.
I'm gonna say that his actions were doing the talking by the sound of things.
And he was absolutely a diamond of a bloke off the field. Like, he was such a prankster. Like, he was the guy who would cut the ends of your socks off and shaving foam in the trainers and all kinds of stuff. He'd be the one that would get the club going and get the team going. And he was he was like the guy that gelled the team together. It was a special time at the time.
Yeah. And without knowing it, mate, are you picking up little attributes from the likes of Leeds, from OKR, to sort of shaping into seeing talent and knowing what bits of talent can get you places and what bits of attitude can't? Are you picking that up, do you think, even at that age?
Yeah, I think so. You know what hard work looks like? There's so many players that I've seen come into the game who were so much more talented than I ever was, but they don't last because they're not prepared to do the things that others are prepared to do.
Yeah,
unfortunately, and that's why
I stand out like a sore thumb. Sorry that
some of it. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does. And so many talented players just won't push themselves beyond that hard work. They won't take themselves into some dark places when they need to. The talent will only get you so far, you know, like we've said already a few times tonight. Without that graft and without that attitude of really digging in, your teammates won't respect you. And if you lose the respect of your teammates, you're gone. You're out there.
Yeah.
Your teammates, when I was playing, would always respect someone who worked hard. Even if you're not the best player, as long as you're trying, then they'll forgive any mistakes that you make, because they know you work hard to rectify it.
So, the spell in us, mate. So, when did the end of the first spell to KR? How did that come about, and why was Australia an option, and how does that come about?
So, I'd been at Rovers for I think it was 9 years. Been there for 9 years. I was just getting into my 30s, 31, and I knew the end was coming at some point. But I had no, like I said, I didn't try out at school. I had absolutely zero qualifications. I had nothing to fall back on. I had 2 years left of my contract. Craig Sandercock came, and we didn't click, we didn't get on. He didn't like me, I didn't like him. I was doing a gym session one day with Joel Clinton, who was an Australian. He was my gym partner and was doing our gym session. And I knew he was going to be leaving at the end of the year anyway. So I was just asking, I said, oh, wait, you know, he got all lined up for next year. And he said, oh, yeah, he's going to a club called Mackay in the Queensland Cup. And they was giving him, you know, a certain amount of money, but they was also putting him through an apprenticeship engineering apprenticeship so he can go down in the mines and work. So it sounded great because you're obviously getting educated, you're getting an apprenticeship where you're getting paid a lot of money as well. So he said, oh, that sounds brilliant. I've always loved to go to Australia. Like, I've been a few times. He said, if you want, I'll speak to the CEO and see if he's interested in getting you down. I said, yeah, do it. And then I got an email off the CEO of the club a few days later. Kind of went from there, really. And then the club agreed to release me. And then assigned to go there for a year. So I went down there. I think it was in the January. I went in there, yeah, just after Christmas in the January. Did a bit of pre-season, but I in a first trial game that they've got there, I dislocated my shoulder, so I was injured. It took me a while to get back. And my wife, it was my wife at the time, she had ended up refusing to come. She didn't want to, and we had a 2-year-old. So, once she'd said she didn't want to go, it was, I got the plane. I got booked the plane for the next week. The idea was I was going to go for a few months, get settled, get us a house and get everything ready. And then she'd come down, but she didn't want to go, which I completely understood. It's a big, big move. I just jumped on a plane and I came back and I've just landed and got in. I was driving on the way home from Manchester Airport, and Neil or Joel rang me, said, What are you doing? Now you're back. I said, oh, no, but not planned. I didn't have anything set up or anything. And he said, oh, meet me tomorrow. And I went and met him and then signed another contract at OK. I went back there.
So just before we talk about your second spell, then, mate, how had you been with injuries, Jace?
I'd not been too bad. Not been too bad. I dislocated my shoulder twice, my left shoulder. Mm. Other than that, I'd not had any knee injuries, which is something I never had in my career, luckily. A few little niggles, broken thumb, just a couple of pulled muscles and stuff, but nothing too serious. I managed to escape them just the shoulders, took a couple of shoulders. So fairly clean bill of health, really.
Yeah, no, you got thanks to yourself and worked hard, so it reaps its rewards in the end, mate, doesn't it?
I'd like to think so. You look after yourself, don't you, and do the best you can. Some people do that and they still get bad luck, so.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one, injury, isn't it? Some of them just can't be helped. Some people... I was very lucky not to have any knee injuries. I'm one of the few that come out of the game without any knee injuries. Took a few bad head knocks, which I'm sure will catch up with me at some point in later life. But it's probably another story.
And what would you like about the sentimental stuff? So the memorabilia and did your mum collect the newspaper cuttings and stuff like that? Little scrapbook.
Yeah, oh, mate, it's a touchy one with my sister, that one. So,
right. Don't want to kick him off, right?
She calls me Golden Child because my mother collected everything, every single newspaper clipping. She's got bloody 24 VHS videos of me playing and CDs, and she's got them all. She had them in a big box. And then a few years ago, she was like, I don't want them anymore. Like, I can't do that with them. You have them. Give them to the girls, two daughters. I'm like, they don't want them. They're not going to want them. When I'm long gone, they're not going to... Who looks through it all? So she said, well, you're going to have it. Put it in your shed. So she brought them. She brought them around, mate. And honestly, it's like four big, massive boxes. My sister was...
Blast that, though.
Yeah, oh, it's brilliant. Honestly, I've got them.
Was there a video player in there, Jace, for the videos or what?
Was there what?
Was there like a video player in there, or was it an eBay job?
No, video. I'm going to have to, I keep thinking or saying I'm going to go and get them converted into CDs, but I probably never will. But during lockdown, actually, my missus was having clear out and all that. She was like, what are you going to do with all this stuff? I said, I think I'll just throw it away. She went, no, don't throw it away. Why don't you turn the shed into a bar and put it, have like a memorabilia wall and all that stuff? So I've done that. I built it's a bar awesome. In the garden and put all my shirts on the wall. Yeah, because I used to give my mum all my every single playing shirt that I had, I'd give it to my mother at the end of every year. So yeah. I've got all them and they're all on the ceiling, and I've got my trophies in a little cabinet that I built and all. Yeah, it's good. But yeah, my sister goes mad. Golden trophies.
So what would it have took for OKR to persuade you to go back, mate, after a little bit, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe a bit of a sour note to leave on with, maybe not being too civil with a coach and that? Is it everything's repairable, I suppose, mate, isn't it, under the right circumstances?
Yeah. I didn't get on with the coach. You know, he was a fantastic coach, but his man management wasn't great. But I knew the chairman, I knew Neil for years and years, obviously since I first went there, and I had a good relationship with Neil. And he just said, come and meet me tomorrow. I met him, we didn't really talk about money. He just said, are you coming back? Basically, yeah. I met with the coach the following day or a couple of days after, and we both just said, look, you don't like me, I don't like you, but we've got a job to do, kind of thing. Get your head down, work hard, and see if you can get yourself back in the team and get fit again. And it was quite ironic, really, because he didn't like me, so he didn't pick me. And he'd do anything he could not to pick me, really, at the start. And then by the time his time at the club had finished, he was begging me to play because I was playing well. The last year of my career was probably my best year. Certainly 5 or 6 years previous, but I found it quite ironic that he got to the point where he was telling me I didn't even have to train, I could play if I wanted to. And then 2 years before that, he wouldn't even pick me regardless of how well I was training. So it was like I won that one. Little small victory.
No. And it's mad because earlier on in your career you needed that arm around you to say, yeah, you're my type of player, Jason. Yet later on in the career, maybe you reinvigorated something in you.
Yeah.
With the dislike, maybe.
Probably. Fire in the belly. But I always had the backing of my teammates. So even my teammates would be going into the office and saying, why are you picking him? What are you doing? He needs to be in the team, et cetera, et cetera. So once you know you've got the backing of them, you feel a little bit more freedom. So that's probably how I felt. And again, because I knew the end of the career was coming, you play with a little bit more freedom anyway, because things don't matter. So you're not playing for a contract. You're not fighting for what's coming next. You're enjoying what you've got left. I probably could have played another year in the end, but I was real happy with the year that I had when I went out because I enjoyed myself. And
it's nice to know you finish on your own terms as well, mate, isn't it? That's a very different scenario as well.
Yeah, it was. I had a bad back injury, not injury, but I had a bad back. I've got a couple of bad discs, and the last year I couldn't do much running. So I'd end up sitting on the sideline on a watt bike and watching the lads train the early part of the week, and you start feeling guilty. You know, they're doing the hard work and you're sat pedaling, turning a bike over, like it's not the same. So it was the right time for me to go. The club had some young kids coming through. They needed to invest some money in them. It would have been, if I was a Jamie Peacock type player who was inspirational and amazing, you might say, okay, well, don't train, but you can play. But I wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, they could give my money to someone else who is going to train and who is going to kind of earn that spot in the team. So it was the right time. But again, like Leeds, when they won the Super League when I left, okay, I got to the Challenge Cup final on the year that I left as well. So I probably should have played another year.
Sat on the watt bike for a bit longer.
I could have played at Wembley. Mind you, they got beat 50-0, so.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it, mate? It's finding the balance. So did you have a role to go into when you made that decision?
The choice I had was, you can play another year. Fantastic. Yeah, there's a contract there if you want it. Or there's a job in the youth development department which had just come. Sean Briscoe had the job, and he was leaving to go back to Warrington.
Yeah.
So the choices are: you can play another year, but this job might not be there for you in a year's time, or you can finish your playing career and step into this job now. Bear in mind what we spoke about, the fact I had zero education. The safe bet for me, or the right thing to do, quit playing and go and get into that job, you know, and see where you go with that. So yeah, that was, you know, the money was the same. So it wasn't like I was taking a massive pay cut. It was the same wage. So it was just like, yeah, I'll just step into that now and finish playing. I can't run anyway. So,
yeah,
you know, go into that and see where that takes you.
So how was it going in and seeing things from the other side of the line, mate? And is it about reintroducing yourself to people as something new? And how was that for you?
It was strange. I'd never had a job. Never had a 9-to-5 job. I left school and went straight to Leeds and became full-time, and I always had a full-time career. So I had never, I'd never had a what you'd call a proper job. So I didn't know what to do. So it took me quite a while to get used to it. Like I'd sit in the office just not doing anything, or put my feet on the desk. And I remember my first day, there was three of us in that department. So they said, oh, come on, we'll go for lunch. We'll go and get a Carvery lunch. So we went to this pub, and there was joking on the way down saying, oh, we'll have a liquid lunch. They was joking. I thought they were serious. So I've gone into this pub, and I've gone up to the bar, and I ordered a pint of Carling or whatever it was. Then two were like, what are you doing? I said, we're having a liquid lunch, aren't we? And they'd ordered orange cordials. I said, no, you don't do it. You're working. You've got to go back to work in an hour. Well, I thought that's what people do. That's what they do in Emmerdale and Coronation Street.
What like, they do to people, don't they?
They do, yeah. And that's all I knew about work. Like, I thought I was going to go have 3 or 4 pints for my lunch and then go back to the office. But yeah, apparently you don't do that.
Yeah. So when you're out on the field, mate, shaping that next generation, what is it you look for in a young player when maybe you've sent your scouts out to club games and they come feedback? What are the key areas you look for in a young player?
Good person. Like a good bloke or a good kid. You know, even if you work hard, if you're a dick, people won't like you.
Yeah.
So you've got to be a good kid first and foremost, and then you've got to work hard. You've got to love what you're doing. If you don't love what you're doing, you're not going to do it to the best of your ability. And if you're not doing it to the best of your ability, why are you even doing it? So for me, it's been a good person, and then being one that's going to really, really work hard. Like I said to you earlier, work hard and see where that takes you. If you don't get through, because there's only 2% of kids that go into a scholarship end up having a career. That's, you know, 2 out of 100. Your chances are very, very minimal. Yeah. So you might as well have a try. You might as well give it all you've got. And then if you walk away, at least you can say you've done your best. So yeah. I'll always say, graft, graft, graft hard.
If you do walk away, mate, you go back to your community club, twice the player, twice the person. So you're only going to enhance that club anyway, aren't you? And
exactly.
Who knows further down the track then?
Go and be a good bloke. Go and play community rugby. Go and enjoy. Some people do that anyway. Some people work really hard, but they find that it's too hard for them, that the environment. They come from the community game where they're probably the best in the team, and they don't even need to turn up training. The coach will pick them on a weekend. So suddenly an environment where they have to work hard is hard. We give them some hard sessions, and some of them just don't want to do it. They go, oh, this is not for me. This is very, very hard. And there's no shame in that.
No, not at all.
Go back to your community club and enjoy your rugby. And some of them just want to have a beer with the mates on a Saturday after a game. And that's fine. There's no issue with that. Go and do that. We're in the business of making professional players, though. So you've got to work out if you're in our environment.
Yeah. And how is it when kids come and they maybe think they're a big fish in a little pond, and did he understand that a lot of you have been there and done that, you know, how they're feeling? Did he reach out in certain ways that maybe your generation might not have?
They get weeded out pretty quick, I think. They get some of them do come in into the academy as you know, their attitudes are fantastic, but the older lads will just weed them out, they'll just suss them out straight away. And a bit like first team level, if you're not a good bloke, if you think you're better than you are, you lose the respect of your teammates. Once that's lost, it's very, very hard to get it back. Very hard, because you form opinions and it's hard to change them opinions. So they don't last very long. They don't tend to not last very long. I've seen many, many come and go.
That's the beauty of sport, I suppose, mate, isn't it? You do get found out, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for the environment, unfortunately for the individual, isn't it?
Yeah, they do. But on the flip side, I've met so many fantastic lads that go on to be successful, regardless of what career they end up with, whether it's rugby league or fire service or police or working on the docks. You know, they're going to do the best, because I think what our game gives you is that ethos of hard work, because you have to. So if you can do that, you're going to be successful in whatever career path you have. That's what I always try and tell the lads. There's so many transferable skills from rugby league into the general working environment anyway. And that's what we encourage all lads to do. Because like I said, the stats are telling you that there's a fair chance you're not going to get a career. You're not going to have a 200, 300 game career in the sport. What are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do when that doesn't work out for you? Get yourself an education. Make sure you're a good person. You've got a good work ethic.
So you're not selling them a lie then, mate, are you? You're just giving them the best platform to thrive in whatever environment they end up being involved in.
The help that these lads get nowadays is so much more than we got back then.
Yeah.
You know, we have a full-time welfare officer whose sole job is to look after the players' welfare, check that everything's okay in schools, in college, at work. If they've got any issues, mental issues or anything, they go and speak to her, and she's outstanding. The coaching staff, there's four of us. Like, there's more coaches than we probably need, but we have them because of what they bring to the club. And full-time physios, full-time conditioning staff for academy is crazy. So the resources available to lads nowadays, there really is no excuse for not trying hard.
It's purely attitude, isn't it, now?
Yeah. So, you know, we've come to the party and done our bit. Now you've got to do the same. Look, I can't speak highly enough for the group that we've got at Ulkay at the moment. They're brilliant. They really, really are brilliant. Hasn't always been the case, but we've worked hard to get this group together and got some pretty high hopes for them, to be honest.
So how are you, the chats being on the other side? So do you know them couple of chats you've had where you've disagreed or you've ended up mutually leaving a club in the end? How are them chats to have when you're the one initiating that conversation?
To be fair, they're pretty easy because the players already know. So you're not telling them anything they don't know. If I tell you that you're not working hard enough and you're going to have to leave, you will already know that you're not working hard enough. Yeah, if I tell you your attitude's wrong, the chances are you already know that. I'm not giving you any information that you already don't have access to, like, because there's a build up before that point. If you're being disruptive to the group, there's a fair chance that we're gonna have a few conversations before we get to the end point. So that end point is not, it's not new. You already know about it. And then conversations that they're not nice to have with young lads, but they're necessary, because you've got to look at the whole group rather than one individual. it's the same when you're picking a team, when you're telling people whether they're playing or they're not playing, they're not that nice to have, but they're necessary because you want that player to get better. So you have to give him the feedback that he deserves, whether he's playing or he isn't playing. So, yeah, I've got a good group of staff there that help me out with them conversations, but ultimately they're there to be had, and that's just part of the job.
Oh, mate, and I appreciate your time. So we'll have some daft questions, if that's all right, mate.
Yeah,
so any pre-match superstitions when you were playing?
I used to have... not daft ones, but I had a routine of you know, when I put the sock on and when I put the other sock on. And I'll give you another little bit of interesting trivia. It's not interesting, but it's weird. I played in the same pair of trunks for every single game I ever played in, from being under 18 to finishing my career. Speedo.
That's a great effort.
Yeah, they didn't wear out or anything. Yeah. I mean, there might be a few stains in there.
Especially when you were on the bench in that semi-final, mate.
I had the same pair of black Speedos for every game from when I was 18 onwards.
Brilliant. So you'd have probably been a big fan of the Budgie when you were playing them, mate, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, these were black Speedos, yeah.
Yeah. You were posh having Speedos.
Well, I'll tell you why I had them, because I hated them when I got them, but I taught Australia with England Academy, Great Britain Academy, and Mike Gregory was our coach. And he'd said, as part of the build-up to us going, that obviously we'd be doing a lot of rehab after games, and a lot of it be swimming, and you have to have trunks. You can't go in shorts. Yeah. So my mum made me buy them Speedos. So I thought, well, I'm never going to wear them for normal swimming in a normal public swimming pool. I'll just wear them for games, and that's how it came about.
Enough, mate. So, again, the word I'll use next, mate, the definition's different for everybody, but the toughest player you've played with and against?
So, toughest player I've played against would be a few. Can you say more than one?
Oh, she can, mate, yeah.
I remember playing Paul Sculthorpe for St Helens. That was dreadful. Andy Farrell, I played against him when he was at Wigan. And then I remember playing against David Ferner when he was at Wigan, and he absolutely folded me in half. So there was, you know, there was tough players. Kieran Cunningham, a tough player. Yeah. Tough player. Toughest player played with. Again, it's certain criteria. So Rob Burrow, tough player. Put his body on the line for someone so small. Then you got your proper tough players like your Barry Max, Barry McDermott. I think Scott Morrell would be up there. He put himself in front of people that he should never have put himself in front of. So yeah, they're the three that stand out there.
Right. So your favourite away ground?
Ooh. Controversial.
And do you like the older ones or the newer ones, mate?
I like the KC Stadium.
Yeah.
Which won't go down well with all KR fans. Simply because every time I played there, it was full. So obviously it was a derby and there'd be 20,000 people there. So the atmosphere was always electric, and all KR was always given the behind the posts side. They'd fill that up and they'd be so loud that well and truly out-sing the LFC fans. So definitely the KC would be my favourite away ground. Headingley, playing in front of that south stand under the floodlights on a Friday night would be outstanding. There's, you know, a bit of a contradiction there with the new and the old.
Headingley's really popular, mate.
Yeah, that south stand when it's full on a Friday night, the crowd singing, matching on together, and I'm lucky that I've done it on both sides, for Leeds and against Leeds. So that'd be up there without a shadow of a doubt.
And I've not asked you, so I don't know why, but how did you find a build-up to a derby being Hull lad?
Nervous, nerve-wracking. You know, I got so wound up to them games, and living in Hull, there's a build-up for a couple of weeks beforehand, so you can't escape it. You can't get away from it. I was again, fortunate to play in a team where we dominated them derbies. We won far more than we lost. So we fed off the news. We fed off the build-up, because we was always billed as the, you know, the little brother and the noisy neighbour and the small club against the big club, etc. So we loved that. We'd put them printouts up on the walls and changing rooms, and you know, we'd be talking about it before games in the build-up about things that they had said in the newspaper and that. So that got us going. Worst place in the world when you lose a derby, though. Oh,
I can imagine that.
That would have an effect for quite a while.
Yeah. Right, mate. So if you've been out and had a few with the boys and the microphones in your hands, what are you giving us on the karaoke?
Penny Arcade.
Yeah.
Don't mind a bit of Penny Arcade every now and then. Bit of gold. The old ones are the best.
Are you going to give us a shuffle or just blast it out?
I'll blast it out.
A little 1-2s there.
No, man, I'd go full hog.
Yeah, get the crowd involved and everything.
Yeah.
So if you could go back and tell a younger you something from what you've learned, mate, what would it be?
Go to school. Enjoy school. You know, put the effort into school, work as much as rugby. Because it was very scary for me towards the end of my career, knowing that I had nothing to fall back on. I had no education. I had no job. No real prospects. I was fortunate that I fell into this job or a job straight away, but if I hadn't have done, I don't know what I would have done. I didn't earn enough money playing to be able to retire or live off that. So I would go back and I'd tell the arrogant Jason in school who thought he was going to be a Super League player that might not happen, and you got to graft your backside off in your exams and do your best.
That's fair enough, mate. And if you're willing to, a 1-13 that you played with, if that's okay.
1-13 that I played with?
Yeah.
I'd go Sean Briscoe.
Yeah.
Fullback. I really enjoyed playing with Sean. I'd go Peter Fox on one wing.
Yeah.
Jake Webster, Chris Wellham. On the other wing, I'd go Daniel Fitzhenry. I'd go Blake Green and Michael Dobson.
These are all partnership, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. These are all Hull KR players. I could talk about the league ones, but I didn't play enough with them. Yeah, not a professional, Super League level.
Yeah.
I'd go Mickey Vella, Josh Hodgson. I'll come back to 10. I'd go Clint Newton.
Yeah. And from Raw.
And then? No, Clint Newton would be number 11. I'll come back to number 10. Benny Glee, number 12. 13. Ooh. Probably Reese Lovegrove. No, Scott Morrell. Still is Scott Morrell. I put Reese in at number 10.
You've been listening to Trot the Eggin'. Thanks to our sponsors, Bardell Sports. Follow us on Twitter @TrotTheEggin and Instagram @Trot_the_egg_in.